Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. It's Jessica here, and I have a great program planned for you today. Do not go anywhere. We have got Hillary Morgan Ferrer on the show today. She is the founder and Mama Bear in Chief of Mama Bear Apologetics. Now, I know there's going to be a lot of you out there who are very big fans of their work, and some of you, this is going to be new. So it's going to be a treat for all of us. Now, Hillary feels a burden for providing accessible apologetics resources for busy moms. Now, that is my category for sure. I am definitely a busy mama. She is the chief author and editor of the best-selling Mama Bear Apologetics, Empowering Your Kids to Challenge Cultural Lies, and the newly released Mama Bear Apologetics Guide to Sexuality, Empowering Your Kids to Understand and Live Out God's Design. Now, Hillary has her master's degree in biology from Clemson University, and she's working on a master's degree in apologetics from Biola University. She loves helping moms to discern both truths and lies in science and culture, and she also specializes in understanding the root causes of doubt. She and her husband John have been married for 15 years, and they minister together as an apologetics team. Hillary, welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We are so excited to have you on today.
Well, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, Hillary, let's just start with the obvious. Like I said, I think that we're going to have listeners all over the map here, but let's just start at the beginning and make sure that we're getting everybody on the same page. What in the world is apologetics? If this is a new term to somebody, what does that even mean? Let's start with that.
So if apologetics is a new term for you, then I have a surprise. You are probably an apologist. You just don't know it. So apologetics is basically giving a reason defense for why you believe something. Or as I like to say, it's trying to get other people to recognize something true, something that you know to be true. So back in first century, like lawyers were called apologists because they would be presenting a case of what they thought the true events were in order for a jury to decide, yes, they're right. This person has presented the evidence. They have presented the case for why the narrative events are true. Now, I would say everybody is an apologist in the sense that we're all apologists for something. I kind of laughingly talk about my mom a lot, that you cannot talk to my mom for more than 5 minutes without getting to hear about why the Instant Pot is the best thing that has ever happened to your kitchen. She will talk to my friends. She will talk their ear off. She will find out why they don't have one. If it's, you know, a matter of money, she will find a way to help buy them an Instant Pot. I can't tell you how many of my friends she's actually bought Instant Pots for because she is so thoroughly convinced of the excellence of this product. And so we are to basically be doing the same, and we should be asking ourselves if we aren't at the place where we are so excited about the message of Jesus, that he really is the one true God, that he really does have our best for us, that he really is the answer for anxiety and depression and hopelessness. If we don't really believe that, then we're not going to be trying to talk to other people about that. But if we truly do believe this, then we're going to be trying to tell everyone, and we're going to be trying to find out what has been your barrier, what has prevented you from being able to interact with this God who loves you so much. And that's basically what apologetics is, Christian apologetics. It's trying to make a defense case, a reasoned case for why we believe that the Christian worldview is the one that most closely aligns with reality, why Jesus really did live a life, a sinless life, die, rise from the dead to save us from our sins, and who God can be in our own lives. That is what a Christian apologist does.
Well, one of the things I love about your book, Hillary, is that you take very complex subjects that may seem really intimidating and you make it so relatable. So Hillary's mom, if you're listening to the show today, I don't have an Instapot. Instant pot? I clearly need to talk to your mom, but how did you go from the daughter of an Instant Pot apologist to, you know, because when kids are growing up, most of them, they want to be an astronaut or a police officer or something like that. Where'd you start in your faith, and how did you end up with a passion to equip others as apologists?
Yeah, so I would say my passion comes from knowing what apologetics did for my faith. I was always very much just a good Christian girl. I loved being in the church. I loved missions. I loved Jesus. I loved the Bible. But it wasn't until my pastor went through a series on apologetics. He started out with what's called the trilemma, the liar, Lord, lunatic, saying, who was Jesus really? Was he a liar? Did he say he was God, but he knew he wasn't? Was he crazy? Was he a lunatic? Did he think he was God, but he really wasn't? Or was he telling the truth that he was God? A lot of people want to say, oh, he was just a good moral teacher, but as we know, good moral teachers don't go around saying that they're God and they can forgive your sins. These are options that Jesus never left open to people. So he went through that, and then he went through the evidence for the reliability of the New Testament documents, and then he went through the evidence for the reality of the resurrection. He went through every single other possible explanation that people have come up with for the resurrection and why none of them held water, and it made more sense and required less faith to believe that Jesus actually did rise from the dead, as opposed to all these different kind of stories that people would make up about it. And that was the very first time that I realized this wasn't just something that I believed because it was cultural, because I grew up in it, because my parents said so. This was something that was objectively true. And just that concept of objective truth, something that was true whether or not I felt it or not, true no matter if someone else felt it or not, that was a different category for me. And so I would say throughout my life, I've had a variety of challenges. I've struggled with anxiety and depression. I've struggled with cancer, multiple bouts of cancer, some really horrific surgeries, my sister passing away, my mom having cancer. Throughout it all, sometimes when it feels like it would be easy to walk away from this faith, I know what I know, saying I feel like I would have to check my brain at the door in order to walk away from Christianity, because I can't find any other thing that makes as much sense of reality as the Christian worldview does. And because of that, I've been able to stay in the faith, and I've been able to place my faith in Christ and in God, even when things don't make sense, even when life hurts. And so I just have a passion for being able to equip moms to do the same thing for their children as well, is giving them a firm foundation. Like I like to say that faith in Jesus Christ saved my life, but apologetics saved my faith. And it doesn't have to be just this thing on whether or not I feel something. In fact, on the Mama Bear podcast, we always say, this might not affect your faith, but it might affect your children's. And just seeing the number of kids walking away from the church, walking away from the faith, walking away from God, we have to recognize that we're having a massive problem that's going on right now. And I think it's because they haven't been taught that Christianity is actually true. They've just been taught this is our preferred religion.
Well, you know, my listeners, our community here, they definitely love their kids. And collectively as parents, we are driven a lot of times by fear in today's culture. And I think when I talk to parents of faith, our biggest fear is that our kids are going to leave the faith. And in fact, about half of all kids will leave the faith. That is a fact. And you call it a youth exodus. And I hear a lot of kids today, especially, being proud of their spirituality, but they reject any categorization of being religious. They don't want to be religious. They're more comfortable being spiritual. And you point out some myths about this in Mama Bear Apologetics, like, oh, they'll walk away, they'll rebel, but they'll come back, or because my kids go to the mission program, or they're there every Sunday, or we pray at home, they'll be okay, or they don't need this training until college. But really, most importantly, you say in the book that the best motivation for apologetics is love. So how can we resist the urge to live in fear that is so rampant in today's society, and instead hashtag, or Hillary, what my husband would call still pound sign, roar like a mother?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that love and fear can be, in a way, two sides of a similar coin. I won't say that they're two sides of the same coin, just because there's a lot of things that we fear, like the more we love someone, the more we fear losing them. The more we love our job, the more we might fear losing our job. So there is kind of a healthy kind of fear that accompanies love. But there's also an unhealthy kind of fear that can accompany it as well. I would say that when you're being motivated out of love, being motivated out of love is a much better motivation than being motivated out of fear. Because being motivated out of love usually comes from pursuing something good, versus being motivated out of fear usually comes from grasping control on something that you're afraid to lose. And a lot of times that can have lasting consequences. I mean, everybody has probably known some friend of theirs who was just absolutely in love with some guy that they were dating, and they were so afraid to lose him that they did all sorts of things that just smothered him. And it kind of ended up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. So having a motivation out of fear can often have the exact opposite effect of what we're wanting to do. So we want it to be a motivation out of love, in the sense that we are trying to show the goodness of God. And one of the things I love about studying science and studying psychology is seeing all these little snippets where, oh, look, psychologists have just discovered that, XYZ contributes to anxiety, but the opposite, contributes to having a feeling of peace. I'm like, oh, really? That's interesting. That's basically what the Bible's already said. like passages about, whatever is good, whatever is noble, whatever is excellent, think about such things. Oh, look at this. When we have positive thoughts of things that we're in gratitude for, all of a sudden that anxiety starts going away. Oh, if only we had a book somewhere that had told us to do this. So we can look at things from psychology. We can look at things from science. A lot of the stuff that I've been studying the last couple of years, specifically from the book, has been with regards to sexuality, and seeing just the proliferation of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, and suicidal attempts that accompany going away from a biblical worldview, no matter where in the world you are, no matter how accepting your country is on LGBT issues, that no matter where you are, for some reason, when you go away from that biblical sexual worldview, you have a tendency to increase anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, and suicidal tendencies. So this would be a motivation of love, in the sense of, I want people to be flourishing. I want people to be going towards that which actually fulfills their souls. And to fulfill those souls, that you have to know what the purpose of that human is. And to know the purpose of a human, you have to know the author of humans. So this all would be positive kinds of things. And these will actually reinforce the Christian worldview. So there's kind of different areas of where with our kids, where we're talking about why we believe this is true, meaning like the evidence, like Jesus Christ living, dying, rising again. But there's also a cultural aspect of it, of what about his commands? Do we see that matching reality and this leading to flourishing? So I think a way to kind of resist walking in fear is to kind of be informed of the different ways that reality affirms the Christian worldview, and then being so in love with the way God designed his world that you just want your kids to engage in that beauty and that enjoyment and that fulfillment as well. And that way they're always pursuing something positive instead of trying to be shamed into not doing something negative.
Well, I am definitely a believer that science and faith coexist in the same space, and that science supports our faith, and faith is definitely supported through science. And I think when you're talking about having these conversations, Hillary, a lot of people have misconceptions when it comes to apologetics. And I think some people picture this brash, kind of rigid, if we're honest, maybe even an obnoxious persona. But one of the statements early on in the Mama Bear Apologetics book is that effective apologetics requires empathy. You must be willing to listen. So when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about that attitude and posture as apologists. You've talked about being motivated by love and working towards something positive instead of defending something negative. And so when we come back, let's talk about how we can have empathy as apologists. Don't go away. We've got Hillary Morgan Ferrer on with Mama Bear Apologetics. We'll see you on the other side of the break.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey there, friends. Welcome back to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We are talking to Hillary Morgan Ferrer, author of Mama Bear Apologetics, Empowering Your Kids to Challenge Cultural Lies. Now, before the break, we were talking about how effective apologetics requires empathy, and you must be willing to listen. And one of the things that I see in Mama Bear Apologetics, which one of the things I love is that Hillary says in the book, no one has to tell you what a mama bear is. We all know that as mamas. Like if you say mama bear, like we've all experienced it. We all know that feeling. It's like, I am going to go to war. I will fight. I will do whatever I have to do to protect my kid. And so Mama Bear Apologetics just really makes sense. But in addition to having empathy, Hillary, you espouse a proactive approach that we must teach our kids to think biblically before they are challenged. And this is something that you and I have a very similar heart on. You say that sheltering is a short-term solution. What I have called that is a defensive strategy. But we need a good offense. You say in Mama Bear Apologetics that the greatest protection is to equip our kids to face cultural lies head on while remaining gracious, loving, and winsome. So how does apologetics equip parents for an offensive, proactive approach?
How that some people think of apologetics, or they think of apologists and they think of them as obnoxious and kind of abrasive. And I just want to affirm those feelings for those out there who have that kind of experience with apologists, that I think there are certain personality types that gravitate towards apologetics because they already have a propensity to want to fight and want to prove themselves right. And if they can do it for, you know, in Jesus' name, then, you know, even better. And so I just want to acknowledge that does exist out there. But like you said, I don't think that's the most effective form of apologetics. I think as apologists, what we want to be doing is looking for what barrier it is that is preventing the person from being able to come to the knowledge of who Christ is. And I think as you're talking about with sheltering versus equipping our kids, what we're doing sometimes when we think that we're protecting them by sheltering them is we're making it so that they don't even know the potential barriers that are going to be coming down the pike in the future. So when they do meet those barriers, when they do, when they are made aware of questions that they didn't even think to ask, or things that don't seem to make sense, by just protecting them and by just not exposing them to any of these ideas, we've basically taught them that there are no good answers that exist to these questions, and they're a lot more likely to fall prey to the lies that these are unanswerable questions, as opposed to if we take an offensive, proactive approach. What we're doing is we're presenting a lot of these ideas first, and then helping them work their way through this. I don't know about you. I'm an analyzer, so sometimes if I have an issue, I will analyze it from every single possible angle. I would say, well, you know, I could do X. Well, no, X wouldn't work because that has all these problems that go along with it. Okay, so that's not an option. Okay, what about Y? I could try to do Y, but well, I see all these other problems that don't accomplish the task. And so I'm actually thinking through each course of action or each ideology. If I were to go to someone who hadn't thought through all those things and they just started giving me advice saying, well, you should do X or you should do Y, I would immediately have all the reasons why their advice doesn't work. And the reason I have all the reasons why their advice doesn't work is because I've already thought about it. And so sometimes people like that will throw their hands up in the air and they say, well, you're just rejecting every single suggestion that I make. Okay, so this doesn't seem like it goes along with apologetics, but it does. So when we have kids, that there are certain questions that are going to make them wonder, is Christianity actually true? We want to be able to go through all the possible objections with them first. Because what's going to happen is they're going to get some college professor, they're going to get some friend, they're going to get some, you know, rabid atheist on Reddit who all of a sudden presents this idea to them. Which would we rather, to have the kid be like, oh my gosh, that's such a good question, I've never thought about it. Oh my gosh, maybe Christianity isn't true. That's option number one. Or do we want to be like, oh, yeah, I've thought about that before, and that really doesn't make sense because of all these different objections that I've come up to, you know, that line of reasoning. That's the kind of kid that we want to raise. They are not going to fall prey to all the lies that are out there because they've already realized how they're lies and why they don't fit with reality. So our pastor's wife, when I was growing up, had the greatest thing ever. If you wanted to have a really great conversation about anything, and I mean anything, you went to her house because she had a mantra that she said, I don't want my kids hearing about anything that they haven't heard in my kitchen first. And so this goes also back to this idea of there's not really a name. I call it the founder's effect just because it needs a name, so I gave it that name. I don't know if it has an actual name. I can't find anyone that knows the actual name. But the phenomenon is this, that the first person to introduce you to the idea immediately gets filed away in your mind as the expert.
That is so true.
Who do we want to be? Yes, isn't it? Who do we want them filing away as an expert on all these questions about the faith? The guy on Reddit or mom and dad?
I couldn't agree with you more, Hillary. Yeah, because, you know, a lot of times parents, they hesitate to bring up these subjects with their kids because they think, I don't want to expose my kids to things of the world or things that they haven't been exposed to yet. But I think, Hillary, in this day and age, when we are living at the speed of a smartphone and information is literally enveloping them, and it doesn't matter if they don't have a smartphone, they don't live under a rock. You know, they live around people that do, where news travels so fast. We must intentionally expose them in a developmentally appropriate way that positions us as the expert, because they know, okay, I'll come back and, you know, I can ask mom and dad about that. And I think, you know, sometimes what we do too as parents, Hillary, is that we want instant gratification from that moment. So for example, you know, when I'm telling my son about something that's happening, he doesn't say, oh, wow, mother, that's so wise, and I just am so appreciative of the kind and compassionate way you delivered that to me. No, what
I'm
he does...
I'm going to go journal about it right now.
Yes, he pulls his hoodie over his head and pulls the drawstring and tighter and tighter until I'm having a conversation with a nose, and he says, we will never speak of this again. But you know what? We do speak of it again. That, I know that is so, that is from Dr. Nurse Mama, people. That is how it goes in my house. But you know what? He comes back and he'll say, I have an awkward question. And you know, one of my children had told me even that they were having a conversation with one of their friends about sexual assault even, and they didn't know what that was and some of the words associated with that. So they're Googling it. I mean, do you want your kid to Google these things, you know? So I could not agree more. I think that's so great. Well, let's move on a little bit further and talk about arguing, because you make a strong case for arguing in this apologetics approach. Now, old school parenting says, because I said so. And I think parents today are, you know, we're maybe hesitant to allow that space to wrestle. And you were kind of talking about this before, but why should, how and when should we welcome argument and pushback?
Yeah. So the because I said so argument, if I can call that, I'm kind of using square quotes on that, really relies on the authority of the situation. So things that aren't necessarily true or false, like I'm your mother, I said do the dishes. Why do you have to do the dishes? Because I said so. That's absolutely appropriate because I'm wielding my authority. But there are things that we are not the authority on. We are not the authority on the historical record of Jesus's life. So we should never say because Jesus lived, because I said so, because your pastor said so. We should never say Christianity is true because I said so, because, you know, that's not the time, because that's not our sphere of authority where we can exercise authority. What we're wanting to do instead is to be giving them the tools to argue. Now, a lot of times parents are saying, no way am I teaching my kid to argue, because they think of arguments as like this emotional back and forth. I'm telling you all my feelings, you're telling me all your feelings, and we just get louder and louder and louder. But what an actual argument is, again, along with apologetics, is presenting a case for something. It's saying, these are my reasons for believing X, Y, and Z. And if I have good reasons and the logic is sound, then this should convince somebody else. Now, this is really difficult in our current society because right now If you look at our emotionalism chapter in the Mama Bear Apologetics book, we are deciding what's true and what's false based on the strength of people's emotions. We need to train our kids that that is not a reliable way to establish truth. That is not a reliable way to establish what needs to happen. We need to have reasons that transcend how we feel, that transcend how someone else feels, that logically follow a progression. And so if they want to believe something, they need to have good reasons for it. So there's a really great article that my friend Natasha Crane wrote years ago titled How I'm Teaching My Six-Year-Olds to Be Critical Thinkers. And so it was just things like, you know, someone took a toy from someone else and they say, well, that's bad logic. Just because you want the toy doesn't mean you can take it from them. You know, that cause and effect doesn't hold water. She said she thought that they were just ignoring everything she said. And the rest of the week, she heard them yelling, bad logic, back and forth to each other, as they were both giving really bad reasons for why they discovered something. Similarly, I had another mama bear email me once, and I would love to remember where this was, that her kid would actually yell out, bad worldview, in a movie if they saw something that was a bad worldview.
Oh, no.
Kids pick up on things that we don't realize. And, you know, sometimes it might be a little scary that they might pick up on things that we're doing that are inconsistent or that are emotional based. But I would say be willing to be embarrassed at your own irrationality sometimes if your kid calls you out on it, if it means that they're going to be able to spot irrationality when there's ideas presented against the knowledge of God. That is a small price to pay for a child that knows how to think critically.
Well, one chapter in Mama Bear Apologetics in this line is about affirming the good and rejecting the bad. And we've talked about that. And mm-hmm. I think that's easier to point out, you know, to say that these choices are not congruent with our worldview and these are not the choices we make. But we, I think, are really not quick to affirm the good. And my view is that that's largely a fear-based reaction. And you give an example in the book of watching R-rated movies or other sorts of forbidden fruit, you know, and sometimes I think as parents, we can just have this automatic like, nope, that's bad, you know, but not really looking at it from all sides. And you talk about how this can diminish our credibility with our children by not acknowledging the good that exists too. So how do we balance those things?
Yeah, first off, I want to kind of address a misconception that some people have gotten from that particular part of the book. They think that I'm advocating, say, yeah, sure, watch whatever you want, and as long as you can find something good in it, then, you know, hoorah. That was not what I'm saying. I'm really not a proponent of rated R movies, mainly because of all the sex that's in it these days, and I just think anytime when you're watching people have sex, there's just nothing good that comes from that. So I just kind of wanted to address that first. However, let's recognize some of the movies that are R-rated. Schindler's List, wasn't that R-rated?
Yes, yes.
Are there things that we need to learn from that movie? Absolutely. So this is what I'm saying is having the chew and spit mentality, meaning we're looking for the good in things, is going to allow us to find truth where it can be found. And it's going to prevent us from having this real black and white of I always reject this or I always reject that. Now, granted, again, there's certain things we should always reject. You know, we should always reject, you know, going to, you know, using a Ouija board. That's not what we're talking about here. But when it comes to culture, are there some things where we can learn even from people who aren't Christians? Absolutely. And so if we're always looking for truth, then we're not necessarily always having to figure out, is this a person that can, you can find truth wherever it can be found. Now, the goal of this would be to know truth so well that you can recognize it no matter where it's found, even if the source is not really reliable in terms of other truths, but that you know scripture so well that you can recognize it there. And so I think this is something where we do have to, filtering is good with kids because they're not born with this knowledge of what's scriptural and what's not scriptural. But we start introducing them to it slowly but surely and getting them to realize that even things that we disagree with, we can find things that are true. In fact, I just recently wrote an article for Christian Research Journal about things that most people missed from the Barbie movie. And one of my theses in this was from a quote from C.S. Lewis where he talks about when he was writing The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's not like he sat down and hammered out a bunch of truths he wanted to get across. It all started out with images, and the truth kind of poked its way in in its own accord. And I think when people are really good storytellers and really good thinkers, truth has a way of finding its way in there, whether they intend it to or not. And so knowing how to look for those things can sometimes help you to interact with people who you might not normally interact. Because Christians have a real reputation of being the party of no, of, you know, things are either all safe or all dangerous. It's all Christian, or it's all from, you know, like Bobby Boucher's mom. It's all the devil, Bobby. and that's not really a good approach to take. And so slowly teaching our kids how to affirm what's good and how to identify what's a lie, take the good and reject the lie. That is where you're going to have a kid that you don't have to fear when they go out into culture, because they are constantly looking. Their brain has been trained to look for the lies and to look for the truth and to not confuse the two, and not just trust something because it's from a trusted source, and not just reject something because it's from a questionable source.
You know, as a pediatric nurse practitioner and expert in child development, I can see how this is synchronous with child development and cognitive development, because when kids are young, they are very black and white thinkers. They are justice minded. You know, everything is about these three little words: it's not fair, or but you said. You know, they don't see those shades of gray. But as they start to enter those teen years, it is developmentally normal for them to start to question things and to see those shades of gray and to see the complexities that are in our world today. And I think it would be a disservice not to guide them through that. And they can't, you know, they believe they're lion eyes. They see good things that come in flawed vessels. And so don't go away. When we come back, we're going to talk about linguistic theft. If you're curious, stick around. We'll tell you what it is. See you after the break.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. So glad that you're joining us today for this great discussion with Hillary Morgan Ferrer, the founder and Mama Bear in Chief of Mama Bear Apologetics. And we have been talking about a wide range of things, from Barbie to Bobby Boucher. So if you've missed out and you're just joining in, then you're going to have to go back and listen to the recording. But Hillary, we were talking about affirming the good and rejecting the bad, but I promised our listeners that we would talk about linguistic theft, which, when I read your book, this actually was a term that I had not heard before, but I could certainly understand it. Basically, elevating emotion over rational thought. And actually, on the show tomorrow, we're going to have my friend and author, psychologist Lauren Gaines, and that's actually what we're going to talk about. It's just kind of the pitfalls of worshiping our emotions and being led by our emotions. But you talk about linguistic theft and words like love and truth and tolerance, and those words being stolen, so to speak. So what does this mean, and how should parents respond in reclaiming absolute truth?
You hadn't heard the phrase linguistic theft, because I came up with that phrase because I've read so many books that talk all around this topic, and nobody has given it a name. And when we did the linguistic theft podcast a while back, I actually had a PhD linguist come on and say, yeah, you're right, we don't have a word for this. So tell your friends, that's what it's called now. And I intended it to be easily understandable. I mean, I've heard some people try to give it words like polysyllabic language, and I'm like, that doesn't tell you anything. But linguistic theft, most people can be like, oh, okay, I understand what's going on with that. Linguistic theft is different. First off, let's talk about how it's different from some words you might have already heard. So semantic shift is just when a word kind of changes connotation over time. So like the word silly, we think of silly like making a silly face, doing something that's funny. But you go back to the Jane Austen era, and silly meant that you basically didn't have two brain cells to rub together. It was just as vapid, vacuous, and just, you know, she talked about her sisters as being the silliest girls who ever lived. That was a completely different time, but there was no like nefarious plot to change the definition of silly. So that's semantic shift. Another one would be the equivocation fallacy, which can be very similar to linguistic theft, but that's where you use multiple meanings that have very, very different connotations, but you use the same word. And that would be like the people who use the word evolution, and they mean small changes within a species, and then they also mean what we call molecules to man evolution, but they'll use the same word for both of them because it's confusing to people. They say, well, we know that evolution exists because we have proof that evolution exists, and we observe evolution happening. Well, they're meaning that in like several different ways for the word. Linguistic theft now is where someone is purposely taking a word that everybody is already familiar with. Usually it's going to be a very morally charged word, changing the definition and then putting that word back into society and demanding that people live by that morality. So, for example, the word love. The concept of love has gone from, you know, wanting the best for somebody to being affirming anything that someone believes. And if you don't affirm something that someone believes, then you are not being loving. Well, that's a completely different definition of love than how we would see in scripture or even how we would see historically for love. Or the concept of hate. In fact, if you Google the word hate, it's not going to be one of the official dictionaries, but the very first definition, I think it's called like Wordnik or something like that. It's the first thing your kids will come across. It has these three decreasingly watered down definitions. One of them is like an extreme dislike or distaste for something, which, okay, we can go for that. The second one is a dislike or distaste for. I'm like, okay, so we've lost the extreme. So now they've changed it from being an extreme dislike, hate, to just a dislike. And then the third definition is like a reluctance to do something out of politeness. I'm like, okay, so that is now hatred. So the guy that doesn't open the door for me, he refused to do something out of politeness.
He hates you. He hates your guts.
Oh, absolutely. Totally hates my guts. So this is the problem that we say we don't want to have hate speech or no more hate. Hate has no room here. You'll see this in all sorts of protests. But this is very confusing for our kids who have been told, you know, the words we're seeing on this are tolerance, justice, love. I think health care is one of the big ones, that as long as you can frame something as health care, well, then you're denying health care for anybody who wants that. Like, what a horrible monster you are. I use the word flourishing a lot because they use the word flourishing or they use the word harm. And in fact, in my linguistic staff talk, I have pictures of these dispensaries that they now have in the Pacific Northwest of sterile needles that are called like the harm reduction dispensers. So that drug addicts can get fresh needles and not have to worry so much about diseases. But, oh, we're reducing harm. Well, according to what? According to getting, more diseases? Yeah, you might be reducing harm. Are you necessarily reducing addiction? No, and I would say that that actually produces more harm. But if you're against something, then someone can say, you want harm for my community. And so all these things are taking advantage of the Imago Dei, the idea that we have the law written on our hearts. We have this kind of knowledge already that we are to love, that we are not to hate, that we are to pursue unity with things of Christ, that we are to fight for justice, that we are to fight against injustice, that we are not to try to harm. All of these are things that are built into our hearts just by fiat of being humans and the fact that the Lord has written his law into our hearts. And we have vestiges of the Imago Dei, that imprint of God in us. But when you take those words and then you change them to where you're now promoting sin, that can be very, very confusing to our kids. So they need to know that this change has taken place. They need to know what this is. They need to know. In fact, I always recommend having a buzzwords board in your house for when you hear of words that you're like, I don't think they mean what that normally means. Well, let's put it on our buzzwords board so that when we hear that, we automatically know, okay, what do they mean by that word?
Well, it can be very confusing for kids, especially when they're younger and they do have that cognitive, concrete thinking stage where everything is black and white. And then what I see is, you know, kids will use a word and not understand, you know, the way that somebody else is understanding it. And then all of a sudden, you know, maybe they're canceled or maybe they're in trouble, you know, maybe they're, like that kind of thing. And then they don't understand what has happened. And I'll tell you, I'll have to put a pin in harm. harm reduction, because that's something I could talk about all day long, and we may have to come back to that. But in all of these discussions, you emphasize four key traits: honesty, humility, humor, and heroism. Can we just break those down? Let's start with honesty.
So first off, honesty is, we need to be able to be honest about not only what's going on in culture, but we need to be honest about what's going on in Christian culture. Because there's a lot of unhealthy things, can we say, going on within Christian culture that we need to, if people are reacting to that, we need to be the first ones to agree with them when Christians are acting in a way that is not honoring to Christ. We also need to be honest about if someone's made a good point. If someone's asked a good question, we need to be honest about if we're not sure about the answer. Sometimes people have a tendency to answer a question that they know the answer to and bypass the question that was just asked to them because they're so scared to admit, I don't know the answer to that question. So just having that honesty, and I would say the honesty is in a lot of ways an aspect of humility. It's being able to see yourself and see others with sober judgment. So you're looking for just, how are things really, not how do I want them to be, or how am I scared they might be? That humility is coming with the assumption that I don't know your heart. I don't know what you've been through. You might have a good point that I haven't thought about. There might be a certain demographic where, you know, XYZ is true, where normally I would, you know, say this is a whole absolute issue. And then I'm like, well, I can understand why someone would struggle over here. It's just having that humility to listen to people, listen to the stories, listen to why they believe what they believe. Because you honestly, you can't answer questions until you know why someone believes what they believe. There was, when I first started giving this one talk, it was called Diagnosing Doubt. I had the subtitle of how to avoid wasting time answering the wrong questions. So sometimes it's like we try to answer the question that we think we hear, but we haven't listened long enough to figure out what is the actual question that's going on there. So just that humility, just to not act like we have it all together, we have all the answers, all that stuff. Now, I cannot stress humor enough. And this is something that we try to do with everything in Mama Bear. And some people take it wrong. They think we're being flippant about things. But what I have found is that when you're humorous, especially with self-deprecating humor, it can go so long, and basically getting people out of fight or flight. This is something that I actually did a paper on back in college, where I was looking at the role of humor in getting people out of fight or flight. And I used, and I can't for the life of me remember what movie this was, but it is a Nicolas Cage movie where he gets captured by a bunch of terrorists. And they're all these, like, really this dark, grizzled dudes sitting around with machine guns. And Nicolas Cage starts telling Yo Mama So Fat jokes, or Yo Mama So Stupid, Yo Mama jokes. He starts telling all these Yo Mama jokes. And you have all these, like, big, beefy, thug-looking guys that, like, are trying to keep from laughing, but then they start laughing a little bit more. And then they laugh a little bit more until they're all putting their guns down and saying, tell us another one, tell us another one. If I could have something that was like just a good physical representation of what's going on in the spiritual realm, sometimes when we bring humor into something, the barriers and the walls and the decision that someone's had to, you know, remain angry about something, you can sometimes dissolve that just by a well-placed joke. And it can actually break down the walls that make them more receptive to hearing truth in a way that they may not have in other ways. And so we find that humor can be extremely effective for that purpose. And then finally, heroism. This is just being willing to do whatever needs to be done, no matter how uncomfortable it makes us. And if that means sometimes speaking up, if that means sometimes having to tell our kids that it's okay for them to get in trouble for certain things because the way culture is seeing it isn't true, or just sometimes the most heroic thing we can do, and I've done this many times, is to absorb all the anger and vitriol of someone who's been hurt by other Christians before. Knowing that when I talk to a person, I'm not just talking to them on behalf of Christ. I'm talking to them on behalf of every Christian they have ever met, ever. And there is something heroic about being able to absorb all that anger and not respond back and even say, I am so sorry that that's happened. You know what? I've had things like that happen to me within the Christian community. That was wrong. So there's just a lot of ways to be a heroic. But those are the four things that we like to focus on.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you, Hillary, I can't help you out that Nicolas Cage movie. I'm more of a Pride and Prejudice, Anna Green Gables kind of girl myself. but I get what you're saying. And you're so right that, you know, and even as parents, I think sometimes we can use humor to diffuse a situation and to, you know, just not take ourselves so seriously. The world is so serious these days and things are so scary and kids are afraid, you know, that one word that they say could go viral and, you know, be humiliating to them, or they could say something that they didn't mean to say, and then all of a sudden they're canceled, you know, by their friends or by their school by saying something they don't mean. And so I think humor is really good. And that, you know, it's backed with science and that's backed with scripture, because Proverbs 15:13 says, a glad heart makes a happy face and a broken heart crushes the spirit. And so I think and all of these things that we're talking about, serious topics, we also need to infuse some joy into these things. And I love how you're talking about that, even in affirming the good. Now, parents may be wondering where to start. Like if they think, you know, I haven't really, the things that you're talking about, we kind of do at home, but we haven't really thought about it in terms of, hey, we're doing apologetics at home, or we're teaching our kids to be apologists. You have some practical advice. You say, know your Bible, gather your resources, carve family time to study together, find like-minded mamas, and practice, practice, practice. So what would you say to those families who are thinking, you know, I'd really like to have some intentional conversation around this and prepare our kids in the way that you and I have been discussing over the last hour? What words of advice would you give?
Yeah, first off, I want to address a lie that I think that a lot of times can be, paralyzing. It's a paralyzing lie, and let's go ahead and dispel it from the very beginning. And that's, to do anything, you have to do everything. Like, oh my gosh, if I start introducing this, then I have to know everything. I've heard so many testimonies from different mamas who talk about, okay, I decided to do one thing. I just started the Mama Bear book. And it was crazy how, like, all these conversations of just whatever was going on in that chapter that week started coming up. And so it's just this beautiful way. I call it the learning portion and the lab portion. For any of you science people, you know that you had the lecture portion in school, and then you had the lab portion for, like, anatomy and physiology. You're learning all about the intestines or the kidneys or whatever. And then you go to your lab portion, and now you have to figure out what all those words look like in an actual fetal pig. So I would say that a lot of times with learning apologetics, you're going to have a lecture portion and you're going to have a lab portion. You're going to have a lecture portion where it's whatever it is that you're learning. And then you pray and you ask. And the Lord a lot of times is so faithful to bring practical situations where you have to kind of engage a conversation or engage a situation using what you've learned. And so I would just say, start somewhere. That's my number one advice. Start somewhere. And I think the Mama Bear Apologetics book, the first one, is a great place to start
because you know what, Hillary? Kids don't need a perfect present. They need a present one. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.